With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you're easily offended, this show may not be for you.
But if you're into that weird fun sh**, you've come to the right place.
You've been warned.
Are you there?
I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic. Okay, stories. Let's get into it.
Hello! Welcome to BSP Believer Skeptic Podcast.
The podcast where two idiots debate weird phenomena.
I'm Chris, I'm the believer.
I'm Cody, I'm the skeptic.
And if this is your first time listening to us, we're an LGBTQ paranormal comedy podcast and proud members of the Podmoth Network.
Yay! And we are coming at you with a full episode.
So hopefully you guessed what the topic is with those two stories that we did in the minisode.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, like either one of those could have been real topics. And in fact, I think for both of us, they were going to be.
Yeah. I had thought about putting it in the main episode, but I used it. I found other stories.
Yeah.
That being said, your story, the Yuba County Five, was actually the inspiration for this topic.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because we were thinking of doing an entire episode on it, but we had some miscommunication about it. So we ended up expanding. I'll go ahead and reveal the topic.
Yeah.
We are talking about mysterious disappearances. Mysterious appearances.
Is that the name of the episode?
It might be. And I think it's fun because for our Theodosia episode, our minisode was on random disappearances. And we kind of turned that into a full episode just because the Yuba County Five was so weird that we were like, you know what? We've talked about this some, but there were so many unexplained paranormal disappearances.
There is so much out there, but very unfortunate, too.
That is true. Oh, that's very true. That's very true. Anyway, it's going to be, these stories are going to be fun.
They're going to be insane. So
Chris was messaging me like, I can't wait to do this one.
Yeah.
So should we do our drinks?
Yeah. I went first last time.
So. You did? Oh, and mine's actually really good.
Even though it was a last minute, literally last minute, we went to the grocery store right before this so he could get a drink.
He was waiting in the car so that I didn't, it wasn't ruined while I ran in and grabbed a drink.
Yep.
But it's a good one. So, okay. So two of my stories involve flying.
Okay.
And one of them.
Two of your stories? You only have two?
Oh, shit. Wait. Oh my God, both of my stories involve flying.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Two. One plus one. And the second one, I don't want to reveal anything too much, but it even could involve birds.
Okay.
And so I found a wine called Hawkstone, and it actually has a big picture of a hawk on the label.
Uh-huh.
And so it ties directly into this. So I think it was really good. The second I get out in the car, Chris goes, "What's your rationale?" So it's a good one this time.
All right. Well, a lot of these cases are very, very interesting and weird. And like we said, unexplained, sometimes due to paranormal circumstances or other stuff. And to me, I think that is very surreal. So I got a non-alcoholic Kolsch from the Surreal Brewing Company.
You made fun of mine. That could apply to every topic we do.
Not
that's surreal.
Hey, but I've never used it before, so
that is.
So it's a non-alcoholic Kolsch beer from the Surreal Brewing Company.
It's actually really cool. I actually like that. And a Kolsch is one of my favorites. So I would probably really like that more than this. This is a cab, by the way. So I'll probably like yours more than mine.
So
Okay, well, I am trying to pull a Cody and uncork this motherfucking wine. Do you want to get into history?
Sure.
You might hear my gasps remotely because I'm setting the mic down.
All right. So, well, since our topic is quite a bit out of the norm for us, history will be too. I mean, I think we all know what a missing person is, so I won't go into that. According to statistics, in 2020 alone here in the United States, there were 543 and 18 missing persons cases reported. The only plus is that this is down 66,000 cases from 2019.
Wait. It went from 66,000
to
200?
There's 66,000 less in 2020 than there was in 2019.
Wow!
Yeah. Which means one of two things. Either missing cases have actually gone down or there are less being reported.
Oh, but maybe because everyone stayed at home because of COVID? People couldn't go missing as much.
But my point, considering all the continuing policing issues we have and continue to have here in the U.S., it's safe to assume less cases are being reported. At least that's what I think.
Oh, that's interesting, Chris. Yeah. That's interesting. Chris. Oh, okay. I did not expect that. So you think people are less
likely
to report. Yeah. Huh, interesting.
Especially persons of color.
True. That's actually a really good point.
So when it comes to the law, many of us have been misled by the media, myself included. Just like the movies taught me, I thought that a person had to be missing for at least 24 hours before it can be reported. It's wrong. Law enforcement stressed that there is no need to wait 24 hours and such cases should be reported as soon as possible. Did you open it? You got super excited.
No. Y'all, I just butchered the absolute...
The cork?
Oh, no!
All right. Since a number of missing cases go cold, many common law jurisdictions consider a missing person legally dead or dead in absentia after 7 years. Do you need help with that?
Can you hear this?
Yes.
I've almost got it, I think. So, wait. So, you could wait 20 minutes and say, my son is missing?
Yeah, they just said as soon as possible.
Wow. Because I wonder at what point the police will take you seriously. That's the thing.
That's the thing. Every jurisdiction is different. Yeah. So, you have no idea.
Okay. Yeah. And 7 years. That's a long time.
Yeah. So, obviously, this can be changed in cases of things such as natural disasters, wars, or other mass attacks or deaths. As media would also lead us to believe, kidnapping of children by strangers seems like a daily occurrence and are the most widely covered kind of missing persons cases. The truth is, these types of crimes are actually rare. Kidnappings make up only a small percent of missing persons cases, and of those cases, the kidnappings are often performed by someone the person knows. Yes, I can hear that, Cork. My biggest issue... Okay. And this is important. I'm going to jump on my soapbox here till the end of history, so deal with it. My biggest issue with the media when it comes to missing person is that racial disparity between a white person going missing versus when a person of color goes missing, you know. Studies show that news bias favoring white individuals is well documented, and they are overrepresented as victims in news coverage, while African Americans and Hispanics are overrepresented as criminals.
Wow, yeah.
Additionally, women have been found to be significantly underrepresented in news coverage unless they are frequently framed as victims that are passive and or dependent.
And and this is specifically tied to missing people, right? Okay.
And that's what I was going to say. Fuck the patriarchy.
Right.
And to no one's surprise, Indigenous women of Canada and the United States go missing and are murdered at a higher disproportionate rate than women from most other communities. This is infuriating, but again, not surprising. Regarding Indigenous women, there's a movement called MMIW, or Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls, to raise awareness of these horrendous crimes. Since 2017, May 5th has been recognized as MMIW Awareness Day internationally. So instead
of Cinco de Mayo, right?
I was going to say, so instead of culturally appropriating Mexicans on Cinco de Mayo, wear red in remembrance of the many missing Indigenous women across Canada and the U.S. Some cold hard facts. Indigenous women are 10 times more likely to be murdered in comparison to the national murder rate here in the U.S. The CDC has stated that Indigenous women under 35 experience a higher murder risk than many other groups. That being said, it is very difficult to gather a lot of statistics for MMIW and even more so for historical records. It has been estimated that since 2016, 5,000 Indigenous women go missing and or are murdered a year.
Holy shit. And you know, the Indigenous population is relatively small compared to others. That's a lot.
Yeah. That being said, numbers are skewed as they often vary from states to communities and even between countries.
Oh, sure, sure.
So why so many of these women in particular? Well, to put it bluntly, it has to do with racism and the blatant disregard for indigenous people, not only from surrounding communities, but from law enforcement as well. For example, of 5,700 crimes, the Department of Justice only had 116 recorded in their database.
Wow.
In addition to all that, many indigenous people happen to live in more remote areas, which means less law enforcement.
Sure.
On top of that, there are higher levels of poverty, addiction, unemployment, and nonviolent crimes that contribute to the violence. So if this is something you would like to help with or you want to learn more, education is key. And obviously not just government documentation, as that will only be tell you a small part of the story, obviously. There's a database called It Starts With Us, who are raising awareness on this epidemic as well as filling in the gaps that law enforcement may miss. If you want to learn more, we'll leave some links in our show notes. And there you have it.
Wow, that was great. He literally did a hair flip at the end of that. He's
it
like,
just Ooh. Infuriates me. It makes me so mad.
It does. I wonder, like, whenever I lived in Page, the Navajo Nation is what yeah. it was called, the Navajo Reservation, and they have their own police force,
yeah.
you know, and so oh, yeah. I wonder how that ties into it, you know, as well, like how they're trained. But I think that's really interesting. Yeah. Did you notice I stopped doing my jokey wine opening whenever you were talking serious? I have wine with a ruined cork, but that's okay. Because yep. I am going to have a little taste of this thing. Literally chewy. That whole taste was cork.
Gross.
Delicious. Okay, so for my first story about disappearances, I am going to be talking about Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Now, this one is fairly recent, and a lot of people may have heard of it in some form or fashion. I admit I knew just the scarcest of details. And so I wanted to go ahead and just kind of share everything that I have because it's really interesting. Because if we're talking about disappearances, y'all, an entire airplane with hundreds of people
went missing.
Disappeared. It just vanished. And so I'm like, you don't get more missing than that. On levels of missing, that is the highest. So at 12:42 a.m. on March 8th, 2014. So this is recent.
That's the day after my birthday.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Happy birthday. Here's a missing plane full of people who are probably dead. Malaysian Flight 370 took off from Kuala Lumpur and turned toward Beijing, climbed to its assigned cruising altitude of 35,000 feet. Farik Hamid, the first officer, was flying the airplane. Mm-hmm. He was 27. This was a training flight for him, but the last one, so he would soon after this flight be fully certified.
Oh, cool.
His trainer was the pilot in command, a man named Zahari Shah, mm-hmm. who at 53 was one of the most senior captains at Malaysian Airlines, and this is all important. It said in Malaysian style, he was known by his first name. And at first I was like, shocking. Like, he's known by his first name. What? Like, they actually took the time to point that out. Yeah. But then I realized that in some cultures, like where this may have been written, that could actually be something odd or something of yeah. note. So, and what's so funny is the rest of the article refers to him as Shah, which is his last name. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to mix it up. Now, in the cabin were 10 flight attendants, all of them Malaysian. Mm-hmm. There were 227 passengers. So up in the cockpit that night, while First Officer Farik flew the airplane, Captain Shah handled the radios. Now, the arrangement, that's pretty standard because it's his yeah. training flight. But Shah's transmissions were a bit unusual. But the tiniest little bit, at 1:01 a.m., he radioed that they had leveled off at 35,000 feet, which is actually a superfluous report where the norm is to report leaving an altitude, not it arriving at one. But
yeah.
because he's so seasoned, it actually is marked in the article as this is something a little odd. 11 minutes later, as the airplane closed in on a waypoint near the start of Vietnamese air traffic jurisdiction, the controller at Kuala Lumpur radioed, Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9, good night. Shah answered, good night, Malaysian 370. He did not read back the frequency as he should have. Hmm. Otherwise, the transmission sounded normal. Now, again, that may sound like a minor thing, but that would be the last the world ever heard of Malaysian Flight 370. 5 seconds after the flight crossed into Vietnamese airspace, the symbol representing its transponder dropped from the screens of Malaysian air traffic control.
What?
37 seconds later, the entire airplane disappeared from secondary radar.
Shit.
The time was 1:21 a.m., 39 minutes after takeoff, and it's never been seen or found. So it vanished from radar out of nowhere and then vanished from the world. Now, it's really crazy, especially because the idea that a sophisticated machine with its modern instruments and redundant communications could simply vanish, that seems beyond almost the realm of possibility in today's world. The Boeing, it was a 777, it's meant to be electronically accessible at all times. So the disappearance of this airplane has provoked a host of theories, right? So naturally, conspiracy theories abound. And I'm going to share a few of the key ones. So one is hijacking.
Yeah.
The possibility of a simple hijack has been brought up by various news outlets, including ABC and the Los Angeles Times. Mm-hmm. Now, I love that it says a simple hijacking, you know, because it's no big deal. Because
it's just so easy to do that.
Yeah, just a simple hijack. You know, just terrorists stealing a plane and killing everyone on board.
Yeah.
Simple. Now, speculation has mounted about the possibility that hijackers took the plane to a remote island, although no group has claimed responsibility. No confirmation has ever been recorded or received from Malaysian officials.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of Malaysian officials, their response has actually contributed to these theories because apparently they've withheld data.
Yep.
They've become non-responsive at times. And that's why, like, the most obvious theory is the plane crashed in the ocean. But it's widely dismissed by a lot of conspiracy theorists because why would Malaysia hide information if it was this plane crashed? We're sorry, you know? Yeah. So that leads us to other theories. One is a terrorist attack. Shortly after the aircraft disappeared, it was claimed that it may have been an act of terrorism, possibly a jihadist attack. Between the 9th and 14th of March in 2014, Media mogul Rupert Murdoch tweeted that the flight's disappearance confirms jihadists turning to make trouble for China. Huh. He actually even suggested that the plane was hidden in northern Pakistan, like bin Laden.
Oh my gosh.
Now, the next one here is really interesting, and I'll be talking about it later too. And it's a pilot hijacking / suicide. Shortly after the flight's disappearance, media reports reveal that Captain Shaw's wife and three children moved out of his house the day before the disappearance. And a friend claimed that Captain Shaw was seeing another woman and that his relationship with her was also in trouble. A fellow pilot and longtime associate of Shaw stated that the captain was, quote, terribly upset that his marriage was falling apart.
Yeah.
Investigators actually listened to 170 interviews of him, and they noted strange behavior recently, especially that the captain had made zero social or professional plans for the day after and forward on after the flight disappeared.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Now, the final theory that I've read is that they're still alive. Some had speculated that the passengers were still alive but could not answer their cell phones. This was based on reports that family members, this is way after the crash, family members, you know, would call the number. And sometimes it would ring instead of going to, you know, a busy or off signal because the phone is, you know, in the ocean and dead. The phones would actually ring. No one would answer, but the phones would ring.
Yeah, because there's a Verizon tower in the middle of the ocean.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly, for that to ring.
Yeah.
So that's why some people are confused and like, I think these people are out there somewhere. We just don't know where. And that is the story of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370.
Or let me add to those theories, because you didn't mention it yet.
What's that?
Aliens.
Oh, because it comes up in my next story.
Oh, okay.
Of course aliens.
Aliens
could come
is
in.
Always a theory for everything.
Always aliens. Yeah. I actually should have mentioned it.
Yeah.
But that was, it's so crazy that, you know, that here's this plane. Bye-bye. Bye, plane.
Yeah, it's so crazy. So, well, for my first story, I'm telling a story about a bizarre double disappearance. These are the disappearances of cousins Raimundo and Narciso Pino.
Oh my God, you just made half of our listeners like jizz in
the Anyways, I picked this story because, like I was telling you earlier, it's not well documented and I felt these two men deserve to be known.
Oh, that's awesome.
This story starts in Chile in 2011, which was an interesting year for the country of Chile. That year, there had been a volcanic eruption that had left parts of the country covered in ash up to 6.5 feet in some places.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of ash.
And that'll become important a little bit later.
Okay. So, interesting.
They got lost in the ash. Oh, my God.
Now, Raimundo Pino was a man who made his living as a farmhand. One day in 2011, he had woken up and left his home to work on an estancia, or a cattle ranch, near the town of El Embrujo. This particular day, Raimundo's job was repairing fences, and according to reports, he arrived at the ranch and put up a barbed wire fence, only to mysteriously disappear not too long after that.
Wow, and I'm so glad I'm not doing this story, because those pronunciations. Raimundo.
Following his disappearance, there had been quite extensive searches for Raimundo with no results.
Wow.
Fast forward to November 2020.
Oh, okay, so several years later.
Yeah, Raimundo's 50-year-old cousin Narciso, also a farmhand, got a job repairing fences, much like his cousin, also near the same town. On November 5th, he left his home for his job, only to disappear mysteriously as well.
Oh, that's strange.
Since that time, searches have been conducted using horses, drones, and hounds, among other methods, to find the missing cousins. In speaking with specialized police forces, they attributed Narciso's disappearance to his heavy drinking, saying he couldn't have suffered the same fate as his cousin and that he must have just been hiding in a cave somewhere.
With his booze.
Yeah.
Wow.
Some family agreed, sort of, also saying that due to his heavy drinking, Narciso could have possibly been hallucinating from alcohol withdrawals, which they think led him to wander off. In the investigation, police found that at the ranch, there was a table set with food and there was sulfur being burnt in the wood stove. According to Narciso's sons, they claimed he would burn sulfur whenever he heard voices or saw things in order to chase the hallucinations away.
Oh, so he could have been schizophrenic, or it's a result of the alcohol.
But who knows? Yeah, all of the above.
So his name is Narciso?
Narciso, yeah.
Wow. That's an interesting name.
Yeah. Police also concluded that there were no signs of violence or struggle. Although footprints were found at the site, they still were not able to find Narciso or his body. Some believe that these two deaths were not coincidental and that there are just more sinister forces at play here.
Yeah, that's weird. But they're so far apart, which is so interesting.
Yeah. You see, El Embrujo translates to the enchanted or enchanted place, but has also been called Puesto Las Brujas, or the Witch's Post.
Ah.
Puesto Las Brujas is believed to inhabit a number of evil spirits that many have claimed to have heard there. As is local tradition, sulfur is burned in order to chase away what they call Cosa y Mandiga. I couldn't find a direct translation for this. The closest I was able to figure out that is Cosa de Mandiga is loosely translates to devil's thing.
Devil's thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cosa y Mandinga is a creature that is said to be a half man, half goat with horns, goat legs, and hooves that lives in caves. It is believed that it is able to shapeshift into multiple things such as a woman, a dwarf, an old man, which all bring bad luck or evil to those who encounter it.
Wow.
To add credibility to this legend, more bad has come to the small village where all this happened. When I say small, I'm talking about 600 people living there. Prior to the search for Narciso, there had been no known COVID-19 cases in this area. But since that search started, and at the time my research was published, there were 40 active cases with over 100 people in isolation.
Shit, in a town of 600?
Yep.
Damn.
This number has probably gone up since, but considering the size of the village, I couldn't find any updated stats. As for Raimundo, the first missing cousin, it has been theorized that due to the amount of volcanic ash, he became disoriented and also wandered off.
Wait, was he just hammering barbed wire while ash is just raining down on him?
I don't know. But I mean,
it's like wading
through kind of
ash.
Like when people do the same thing with snow. They go snowblind, you know?
Oh, so that means that at that time, it was just actively falling all around him?
Apparently.
And he's still working?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that is wild. Could you imagine that, just being in an ash storm?
Yeah, it's
Could
crazy.
You make, like, ash angels? Huh.
Well, as of December 2020, Narciso is still missing. The cops have stated, quote, the search will not stop until he is found. As for the town of El Embrujo, many members of the community still believe their disappearance is due to evil forces saying it's witchcraft. And that is the strange and mysterious disappearances of Chilean cousins Raimundo and Narciso Pino.
Wow, interesting.
On a dark night, you make a wrong turn on the highway and find yourself alone on a country road. You're unnerved, but the road is too narrow to turn around. As your tires crunch over the gravel, you turn the radio up to calm your nerves, and all you find is static. As you reach the end of the dial, you stumble upon a show you, nor almost anyone, has ever heard. Congratulations, you've stumbled upon the Lost Signal, a midnight sanctuary of terrifying audio plays to chill and fulfill. Find us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, okay. Are you ready to get real weird?
Oh, wait till you get to my story.
Yay! Man. Okay.
So it just gets weirder and weirder. No,
we kind of got the normal shit out of the way. Okay,
yeah,
that's like
so
the stuff.
Normal. Yeah, so that's normal.
So normal. Now, hopefully you kept listening because, all right, I'm going to be talking about The Vanishing Children.
Do they like clap on, clap off?
It's even weirder. You're going to see. Okay. They're going to wish that they were clapped off. Okay, that, never mind.
That's weird.
Yeah, let's just skip over that. It was Christmas Eve, 1889, and the holiday festivities were in full tilt at the Larch Farm just outside of South Bend, Indiana.
How old were you then?
damn, but did I make fun of you in this or the minisode?
The minisode.
Oh, well done. I was four. So the jolly mood that this night on Christmas Eve was helped along by the scenic landscape freshly coated by 5 or 6 inches of new fallen soft snow.
So we go from ash to snow.
Ash to snow, exactly. So ash, a snowblind. Along with the Larch family, the family's minister and his wife were in attendance, as well as a circuit judge. So it's basically like friends and people. So this is like a gathering.
A little Christmas party.
Yeah. The group had finished dinner and were singing carols accompanied by Mrs. Larch on an organ in the parlor. She had been the church organist for several years.
I wonder if the Dickens carolers were there.
I mean, Sal's old enough. Oh my God. Sal! They could have been. 11-year-old Oliver Larch was sharing popcorn he'd just popped on the range in the kitchen. Nice. It was a little before 11 o'clock when Oliver's father asked Oliver to run out back to the well and bring in a bucket of fresh water, as the available drinking water for the party was almost gone. Mm-hmm. Oliver slipped on shoes over shoes, and took the bucket out the side door. About 10 seconds later, he screamed, "Help me, help, they've got me, help." They all heard, and so they jumped up and they rushed to the boy's aid. They threw open the door and they lunged into the night, while they were met with a terrifying silence. Oliver was not there. Literally, not more than seconds had transpired from the time he walked out of the house to hearing his screams. Holding a lantern high and walking on, they followed the boy's tracks, only to discover that they just stopped halfway to the well. They stood in stunned silence, not comprehending how this could be. Mm-hmm. Then they heard poor Oliver screaming again. And now we come to the most horrifying fact of all. Oliver's screams were not coming from out in the woods. They were coming from above them, somewhere overhead in the sky. This is in the 1800s, in the motherfucking sky.
I thought you were going to say he was coming from the well.
Oh, no, not from the well, but the sky. They could not see him and they could not help him. All they could do was stand in disbelief as his screams for help slowly faded away and they couldn't see him in the sky. It got quieter and quieter, right? It could be because he was never heard from again.
Oh, shit.
The lamp revealed Oliver's path to the well, his footprint standing out in the snow. He had walked 75 feet about halfway to the well.
Uh-huh.
At that point, his tracks just ended. 15 feet to one side, the water bucket was lying in the snow. There were no other prints, tracks, traces, nothing.
What?
So that alone is crazy, but that story is not unique. 16-year-old Charles Ashmore of Quincy, Illinois, stepped outside one cold November evening in 1878, so it's kind of the same general area.
11 years earlier.
Yep, to fetch water from the well.
Okay.
Strangely, he never returned. Fearing for his safety, his father and sister went searching for him with a lantern. Thanks to the thin layer of freshly fallen snow, they were able to follow his footprints. However, the trail went completely cold halfway to the well without a single sign of struggle or anything. The two returned home, dumbfounded by his disappearance. Yeah. His mother paced back and forth from the house to the well, seeking answers and clues that were nowhere to be found. On the fourth day of patrolling, she heard Charles's voice calling out to her, coming from somewhere above as she stood by the well. She yelled for him, like, "Where are you? Tell us how to find you, you know?"
Yeah.
She couldn't see where he was at, and she never received an answer. The voice was believed to be a hallucination caused by her anxiety, but for months afterwards, at irregular intervals of a few days, the voice was heard by every family member and by other people. all declared it unmistakably the voice of Charles Ashmore. All agreed it came from some great distance around or above them, articulate but so faint. Now, over the weeks, the voice grew quieter and quieter until by midsummer it was heard no more.
This is fucking weird.
Yeah, and that's not unique. Another 11-year-old named Oliver,
son of Mr. Thomas.
The other one was 16.
Okay, sir.
Yeah. He also vanished while going to fetch water from a well on Christmas Eve 20 years later in 1909.
Who's the well kidnapper?
Yeah, like, right? Like, don't ever go to wells. I have a fun debunk theory for this.
Okay.
The boy's footsteps also stopped in the snow, and he too was heard to cry out in terror from above before disappearing forever. So what the fuck is happening?
I don't know.
All these similar circumstances, right? Now, they appear to have been lifted up in the air and carried off, but no explanations involving kidnapping in this way, like, makes sense.
No.
They said, like, you know, it could be predatory eagles or hawks, hence my whine, but an 11-year-old boy weighs about 75 pounds,
yeah,
which they say is more than the capacity that an
not
eagle
a pterodactyl.
Could carry. Right, right. That's exactly what I was thinking, but it could be a Mothman. No balloonists reported in the area, and this was before the time that airplanes were everywhere. So when all the things were said and done, and there'll be some documents I'll talk about later, it was there were believed to be cases of UFO abductions.
Okay.
But with no proof.
Of course, always of aliens.
Anything.
That is so insane.
Isn't that wild? Could you imagine the horror of hearing your child above you getting quieter and you're looking screaming and you can't actually find or see him?
It sounded like you said the horror.
The could horror. You imagine the horror flying away?
That's crazy.
Yeah. So now get into your windy, loopy story.
Well, buckle up, buttercup, because this is crazy. For my second story, I'm going to tell you about a set of mysterious letters known as the Circleville letters. This one's a little longer, but it is completely worth it, let me tell you. Let me get into it right away.
Okay, I'm ready.
Circleville, Ohio is a small town south of Columbus with a population of around 14,000 people.
A lot of our stories are in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Huh.
That, I don't know. That, the town is mostly made up of manufacturing factories and is also home to Ohio Christian University. In 1976, a woman called Mary Gillespie, a school bus driver, received a letter in the mail with no signature or return address. The letter accused Mary of having an affair with Gordon Massey, the local school district superintendent, and warned her to stop, saying, quote, "I know where you live. I've been observing your house and know you have children. This is no joke. Please take it serious."
Wow. Calling her out.
Yeah.
Well, this is like being put on blast, but in the olden days.
Yeah. Soon after, Mary's husband, Ron, also began to receive letters with threats to kill Ron if he refused to tell the school board about the affair.
Wow. Do we? Okay. You might get. Was she having an affair? Are you going to get into that?
Well, I'm not going to tell you any of the details. You have to come along on the journey.
Okay. All right. I'm ready. I'm here. I'm paying attention finally.
After Mary denied these allegations, the couple decided to keep the information to themselves, hoping the letters would just stop coming. So, as you probably guessed, the letters continued with the threats. One letter informed Mary if she didn't stop the affair, the information would be released over CB radio and billboards. How 70s, you know?
Breaker, yep. A whore.
Yep. This scared the couple enough that they began telling others about the incident, starting with Ron's sister and brother-in-law, Karen and Paul Freshour. After speaking with them, something clicked, and Karen thought she might know a possible suspect.
Oh.
David Longberry was a bus driver who had tried to flirt with Mary, and she thought, since she didn't reciprocate, that he might be the one harassing her and Ron.
Hmm.
At that time, Ron decided to basically write a sort of cease and desist letter to the bus driver to let them know that they knew what he was up to.
Were they handwritten letters?
Mm-hmm.
I would want to get the bus driver to write something and compare it. Like, hey, sign this. Huh.
Well, this worked.
Oh.
For a short time.
Oh.
After a few weeks of no letters, Mary and Ron started to see signs that were put up in the community stating not that Mary and the superintendent were having an affair, but rather that the superintendent was having an affair with Mary and Ron's 12-year-old daughter.
Oh, what?
Ron promptly ripped off all the signs down and things lulled for a few weeks when then Ron received a phone call.
We have a picture of, like, what were these signs made of?
I don't know.
Like, someone went through some trouble.
Yeah. The caller informed Ron he knew where the family lived and described what their vehicle looked like.
Wow.
Ron thought he recognized the voice, which led him to grab his gun and leave the home to confront the caller. Not long after Ron left, the gun was fired, and he was found dead behind the wheel of his truck.
Ron was found dead?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, shit.
In the investigation that followed, authorities were unable to find any bullets or bullet casings at the scene, but found Ron had alcohol in his system. Based on that, they believed Ron had accidentally driven into a tree, but his family disagreed, saying that Ron wasn't known to be a heavy drinker. The police did say they had conducted a lie detector test on a person of interest, which that person passed, so they let them go.
Wait, so but he wasn't shot?
No.
But they heard a gunshot?
Yeah.
And okay.
They couldn't find the casings, nothing.
Wow, okay.
So, well, instead of the letter stopping, they were now being sent all over the community, accusing the authorities of covering up Ron's death, saying his wife and the superintendent were the murderers.
Wow.
After Ron's death, Mary admitted to an affair with Massey. But she,
oh, shit.
But she said it began after the letters were being sent, not before.
She's like, I never thought about it, but these letters... I was like, huh, that sounds like that could be a good idea.
So it sounds totally sus.
That is so sus.
Not long after this admission, Mary was on her bus route one day when she encountered an obscene handwritten sign about her daughter. Mary stopped to remove the sign, putting it back in her vehicle. Later, she took a closer look at the sign and found a small container attached to it that had a handgun in it.
Holy fuck.
It was rigged. Removing the sign was meant to pull the trigger on the gun, which luckily failed.
Holy shit. What the fuck is happening? This is a true story?
Yep.
Wait, didn't you say she was on the bus?
Yeah.
But then you said she stopped and got out.
To get the sign and then put
it. So she's like, bus driver, can you
pull she wasn't like, she was... on her route, but she was done with
whatever. Like, do you mind pulling over so I can get this gun sign? Okay.
Well, the authorities tried to trace the gun, but the serial number had been removed. Eventually, they were able to identify the gun, finding it belonged to Paul Freshour, the brother-in-law.
No way.
Paul stated he was innocent, but there was too much evidence against him to prove otherwise. Not long after, one of his coworkers claimed Paul had bought the gun from him for $35. It was also found that Paul had taken that day off the same day that Mary found the gun, and that according to the handwriting experts, his handwriting matched to that of the letters being sent around.
Holy shit.
Paul admitted to buying the gun, but said he didn't know what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Ooh, although he was not formally charged with writing the letters, in 1983, after a one-week trial, Paul was found guilty of attempted murder using a firearm and was sentenced to 7 to 25 years in jail. Despite Paul's imprisonment, the letters kept coming.
Oh, no way.
Paul himself even received a letter that taunted him after being denied an early release after a parole hearing. Paul was released after 10 years.
But they said that the writing matched Paul's own. So did they do a test on these new letters?
I guess not. I don't have that information.
Oh, my God.
Paul was released after 10 years in 1994, still maintaining his innocence. Later that year, the story appeared on Unsolved Mysteries. Following the episode being aired, a postcard was received from the alleged same writer. It said, quote, "Forget Circleville, Ohio. Do nothing to hurt Sheriff Radcliffe. If you come to Ohio, you El Sickos will play. It will pay the Circleville writer." Since that time, the Circleville writer to date has yet to be identified. In all, a total of 1,000 letters were sent from the Circleville writer. It has been alleged that Paul had admitted to writing between 40 and 50 of those letters. More recently, it was suggested that there were multiple letter writers. The authorities still believe Paul was the culprit. Following his sentence, Paul had a blog for several years and eventually passed away in 2012, much like us now, never knowing who the Circleville writer was or is.
Wow, that's crazy. So I was about to say, like, whenever the new letters came, wouldn't, like, he be released? But I guess that's separate from the case of the gun.
Yeah.
So it's just a different thing. Wow. Okay.
So I took you all on a journey there.
That is wild. What a fascinating story. I want to know more about that. What the fuck?
Yeah.
So I take it you don't think that it was him then. Maybe the gun. But what were they saying his motives were?
Oh, I'll get into a little bit when I get into my believer.
Okay.
I theorize that's what I do for my believer. So let's get into
it. Yeah. Believer skeptic. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So for the Malaysian flight, I'm going to talk about a couple of the theories and some debunks around them, and mm-hmm. then kind of get into one that, I don't know, sounds kind of, could be kind of likely to me, but I can't say for sure, but about the hijacking and pilot suicide. Mm-hmm. Within a matter of days, primary radar records salvaged from air traffic control computers revealed that as soon as the flight disappeared from secondary radar, it turned sharply to the southwest, flew back across the Malay Peninsula, and banked around the island of Penang. That's important. Mm-hmm. From there, it flew up northwest up the Strait of Malacca and, you know, blah, 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 like other stuff, where it faded beyond radar range into obscurity. Mm-hmm.
That part of the flight took more than an hour to accomplish, and that alone suggests that this was not a case of hijacking, because it was all winding around. Like, it kind of went around. Like, if hijacking, they have a destination.
And it's like on a straight flight. Yes. Like, this is where you're
going. I'm taking you here, right? And I've also found that interesting that, what the hell, this flight is going all over the place. Like, what does that mean? They also said that this didn't seem like an accident or pilot suicide scenario that anyone had ever encountered. Well, I actually will kind of maybe disagree with the second half. So what I believe is the captain being involved in some way to me feels like it could be very likely. Mm-hmm. I even found, in addition to the information I listed above about his life falling apart, I found this information, which was a result of the stuff about what I just mentioned earlier, about the flight path that he took.
Okay.
Former British Airways senior Boeing 777 pilot Simon Hardy told BBC News that the plane's weird route was probably very accurate and deliberate rather than just a coincidence, and noted that the aircraft's turn toward the northwest allowed a clear view of the captain's home island of Penang. And remember, it circled around that entire island. Then he said, and I quote, "Someone was looking at Penang. Someone was taking a long, emotional look at Penang." So they think that the pilot did that because he's circling around his home before flying off and basically killing everybody.
Weird.
Which is super crazy, right?
Yeah.
So now, I will admit that in very recent times that they have actually, people have found what they believe to be pieces of the wreckage floating ashore.
Yeah.
So it's looking likely that it's probably, you know, crashed into the sea. However, you still can't say that the captain didn't do it versus it being an accident.
Because we'll never know if it was intentional or not.
We'll never know. Yeah, we'll never know what really happened. But it sounds like, wouldn't that be so crazy? This captain just loses his mind and decides to kill everyone on a plane.
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible. Now, the vanished children, this one's a little bit maybe more disappointing. So, experts first
there
became,
wasn't a serial
kidnapper. Right? Experts first became aware of this story as they were studying an annotated copy of Morris Jessup's The Case for the UFO. Jessup was trained as an astronomer and wrote one of the many books about UFOs that entered international distribution in the mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
In that book, he discussed strange disappearances, and one of those he wrote was about Oliver Larch. He claimed that all the records existed in the South Bend, Indiana Police Department for anyone who cared to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent this document to the Office of Naval Research in the mid-50s. The letters were thought to explain some of the mysteries of UFO phenomena. Now, these documents apparently were so official that they were taken seriously by high-ranking naval officers.
Mm-hmm.
However, one researcher decided to dive into it a little further. And he said that everything was written down in the records of South Bend Police Department. I called them. They told me that their records didn't go back that far. There had been a fire, and many of the police documents had been destroyed. They didn't have anything prior to 1920. Kind of finally, a kind of damning problem is that weather records for both December of 1889 and December of 1890 reveal that the weather was surprisingly warm, with highs in the 50s. So in other words, the weather was warm enough that there would be no freshly fallen snow for young Oliver and his footprints.
Okay.
So there's all these information records maybe and the story that suggests it happened.
But it doesn't
but then
answer
this
anything.
Guy kind of thinks that this actually was made up somehow. Now, I think that if that's true, I love that the idea that this could be a reverse cautionary tale. Instead of parents telling their kids not to do this because they're going to get taken away, this is parents telling their kids, don't make me go outside and work at night, because if so, I could get taken away by an eagle. And so it's like parent, like the kids getting their just desserts against the parents.
That is so funny.
Yeah, and that is the debunk.
Interesting. So Believer is obviously a little different this time around, since these are true stories.
Mm-hmm.
In my first story, I don't think there's anything paranormal at play, as some believed. Although I don't think that the connection is simply coincidental either. I think someone knew of the relationship between the two and either kidnapped and killed them, or both. Considering the size of the village, I don't think someone would kill them randomly, since everyone would find out, obviously.
Right, right.
I don't know a lot on the background of the Pino family, but maybe they were indebted to someone or something along those lines. These men came from a small community, which the culprit probably thought no one would really miss them, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Just like it goes for MMIW, I'm sure. The only thing I find strange is that the bodies have never been found. So
Crazy.
As for my second story, there's so much that I find suspect. I mean, why would Mary say her affair started taking place after the letter started being sent? Doesn't make sense to me. Another fact I left out of my story that is kind of important is that when Mary found the sign with the gun that day, another bus driver was around there somewhere, I guess, and said that he saw a yellow car that was parked nearby with a man who looked nothing like Paul standing next to it, like pretending to pee. So like some...
Interesting.
And the police never looked into that.
That's so weird.
So he was never identified. Also, Paul and his wife were going through a nasty divorce at the time. So I'm not saying this is a factor, but what I'm saying is I don't think Paul wrote the letters, even if he did commit the murder.
Right, right.
I think there was someone else that was very aware of the affair, and Mary admitted to it only because she was, in a sense, scared into it, you know. Mm-hmm. Coincidentally, the letter stopped coming out long after Paul was released from prison and have not been seen since, as we know. I also think that was intentionally calculated, and whoever was sending them wanted it to make it look like Paul was the writer. But alas, that is my own speculation. And this is a story that will stay with me for a while and keep me up at night. I just want to know who wrote the fucking letters.
I know, right? Oh, and if Paul was really innocent, I feel so bad for him.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Ooh, that was all right. I'm actually like tired. Like, ooh, that was a journey.
Yeah, totally.
That was awesome. That was so good. Yeah. Okay, so we're moving on to Creep of the Week.
Yes, so last week I left you with the cliffhanger from our friend Lern, who told us about her experience with Bridget dolls, and we were left off where she had swallowed the pins.
Yeah, and it said I swallowed a fucking sewing pin, a 2-inch long, sharp as hell sewing pin. Ugh. All right, now I continue.
Yes.
Talk about a living nightmare. I was rushed to the hospital, but got to endoscopy too late. The pin was already in my large intestine. Ugh. The entire time I was scared and borderline hysterical. The hospital never saw anything like my case before. I was being told I may have to have invasive surgery where my entrails would be removed and have to be manually searched for the pin.
Oh my God.
Ugh, something a 25-year-old should never have to deal with. The reality of the situation was ultimately terrifying. I thought, how in the ever-loving hell could this have happened? I was so convinced I needed to be discharged from the ICU to make it to my next show, I couldn't even wrap my head around everything.
Yeah.
My best friend was with me that night, and we were talking about what happened when she asked me about my candle. She said, "Don't you think it's strange that this happened right after you started burning this candle?" I yelled, "Oh yeah, Kelly, Bridget wants me to have a life-changing surgery because I decided to burn her candle." She looked at me seriously and simply said, "Maybe she's just trying to scare you straight." Kelly promised to burn the candle for me at home, despite me being freaked out. She believed it was for the best, and being that she had been my best friend of 20-plus years, I let her at it. Meanwhile, the hospital closely monitored my progress. They took x-rays every few hours, watching the pin travel through my body. "Sorry if this is too TMI," she says. "It's definitely not. We want more." Ultimately, I was told there were only two options. Option one, the pin impales my organs and I'm rushed into surgery.
Fuck.
Or option two, I pass it on a potty break. Ooh. Hopefully that means number two.
Yes.
I was ordered no foods, only water. I had blood drawn from me regularly. I wasn't allowed to move unless going to the bathroom. I was absolutely miserable. Kelly kept a candle burning and sent me pictures of her altar she made for me. I remained frightened for days. Day 5. By an absolute miracle and with no pain at all, I passed the pin.
Fuck.
I was over the freaking moon. Coincidentally, this was the final day my candle burned. From that point on, I looked at my life far differently. I felt like I got a new lease on life and my world was different from then on. I made great health choices, learned to say no, and got my life in order. The entire experience reminded me how precious life is and that you shouldn't take anything for granted. Also, never mess around with magic unless you were serious and know what you were getting into. Sorry for such a long story. Not at all. That was fascinating. I'll post a picture of my x-rays so you can see for yourself. Fantastic job, friends. So happy for your success on your amazing podcast.
Thank you, Lern. That story is intense and fucking crazy, and I'm glad you made it out alive.
Yeah, and I'm glad that, you know, you took it and were able to use that to make a lot of positive change in your life.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So I guess, like, how did you know you passed it? Like, did you have to actually, like, go in a a sieve and search through it like panning for gold.
Gross. Anyways.
Okay. It's just a random curiosity. Oh, God. That's a great fitting in for this episode.
Yeah. So, and with that, guys, thank you very much for coming along with us on these journeys. They're crazy today. So,
yep.
You can find us on all your podcatchers, searching BS Pod PHX. Leave us a rating and review. We love those. If you have any stories, send us an email or with your stories, your weird stories, to bspodphx@gmail.com.
Yeah, we've already got a hypnosis story we'll be sharing next week. So yay.
Yep. And find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. at bspodphx.
PHX. Yay. And if you enjoy the podcast, you know, if you don't mind, tell some friends about it.
Yeah.
You know, give us a little promo. That would be wonderful. And then my books, The Gay Teen's Guide to Defeating a Siren, as always, are all three available. Working on my next book. So that'll be out hopefully sometime, not 3 years like book three was. But everyone, hopefully everything is going well in your life and nothing disappears.
Yeah.
You don't lose any people. The only thing you want to lose is pins from your entrails.
Yeah.
And with that... Bye! Bye.